I'm heading south on Shell, Shell, Shell. Car's going well, oh, it's easy to tell. The oil in the engine shell.
Big companies seem to rule the world, don't they? I mean, they're just enormous. Apple, Walmart, these companies, really beggar belief in their size. And it begs the question whether, in fact, they rule the world. Because, of course, they can talk directly to governments and make their views very, very clear about where policy ought to go and shift around as if they're not a person, because really they're not a person, they're a legal entity. So it raises the question, who is more powerful, states or corporations? Joining me now to discuss just that is Milan Babic. He's a doctoral researcher at the University of Amsterdam, and he's joining me by Skype from Amsterdam. Milan Babic, welcome to Counterpoint.
Hello, nice to be here.
Now, there are some huge companies in the world, aren't there?
Right, yeah. Even more today than we've ever seen in history. You mentioned Apple, but there are, of course, a lot of big, globally active companies that seem to, yeah, as you said, rule the world, in quotation marks.
I mean, it surprises me if apparently if you look in terms of revenue generators that after Walmart comes a number of Chinese firms, three of them, then right. Royal Dutch Shell, then ExxonMobil, right. then Volkswagen, then Toyota, and then Apple. Apple's, you know, right. a fair way down the chain. But in yeah, any event, they generate revenue in excess of India, Norway, Russia, Austria, and Turkey. So they must do something, mustn't they?
Yeah. Right. So what you mentioned is a comparison that we made based on revenues, and what we took off as revenues for countries is mainly their collected taxes. And this is, of course, a very crude comparison because it doesn't tell us much except for that we compare them in size so that we can compare companies and states. And of course, I mean, you mentioned that Apple is, let's say, on the 23rd place and Royal Dutch Shell is bigger in that sense. But this is only one dimension of the power that global corporations have. You can see that, for example, Apple is very active when it comes to, you know, meeting with political leaders around the world, with interventions in political discussions and these kinds of things. And also, of course, they have a brand that is also very powerful in itself. So what I'm trying to say is that there are many, many dimensions of corporate power. And this table that you mentioned is one dimension of corporate power.
Well, given the size of these companies and countries, it's tempting in one sense to say, well, you know, which one does have more power? But there's a third sort of combo in there, isn't there? And that's the state-owned enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Right. What we see there is that in the last years, especially since the financial crisis, but also before, we saw a rise of state-owned companies in the global top, let's say, 500 companies in the world. So if you look at the Fortune Global 500 list, there were approximately 10% state-owned companies in 2005. And in 2015, there are already 25%, so almost a quarter of the 500 biggest companies in the world are state-owned companies. So this is something that we also look at our project in Amsterdam. We have a project that is dedicated to the rise of these big state-owned multinationals and also sovereign wealth funds and everything that's connected to the state, basically. And this is a really interesting development in the last years. So that states rise as owners, that they concentrate ownership like other big institutional investors do. And this is something that we see going on right now in front of our eyes.
Apparently, if you're looking at the global corporate owners, they now control almost one quarter of the Fortune Global 500.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty substantial, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So it always depends on what we understand as state ownership or how we look at state ownership. So one might say, of course, you know, if China or Russia rises owners in the global economy, this is something bad. You know, if you look at the new Russian geopolitics or the Chinese expansion, one could argue that this is something that is maybe terrifying. But what we try to do is to analyze that more from a long-term perspective, to look at how this embeds or how this integrates into global capitalism. And in fact, what it also could mean for international politics, because we don't know that.
No.
There were never so many state-owned multinationals as there are today. So there's no historical role model or no historical situation that has been similar to this one. So
we need to carefully analyze that.
Yeah.
But if you have very large investments in a state-owned enterprise, it gives you some sort of leverage, doesn't it?
That's true. So in the project that we are now doing on state-owned enterprises, we try to distinguish a little bit between states that invest portfolio, which means that they have less than 10% ownership stakes in companies. So a good example of that is the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund that invests small stakes in big companies like Amazon. And on the other hand, you have states that have another strategy. They try to fully control the subsidiaries or the companies that they invest in abroad. And the perfect example for that is China, but also Russia. So Russia, for example, has over 90% of its transnational state capital located in these fully owned enterprises. And this gives them a little bit of a different type of control that they have over their investment, right? So if you fully own a company, you have obviously more control over it than if you invest a little bit in a globally active company. So there are differences in how states try to transnationalize, basically, their investments.
Mm. Can we talk for a minute about tax? Because I know it's of concern to the Australian government, and we've joined with a number of other governments trying to get a better arrangement for taxing these multinationals so that somewhere they pay their fair share. But you mentioned that in addition to places that are tax havens, there's a number of EU countries that are actually encouraging this by offering sweetheart deals.
Right. They are so-called APAs, so advanced pricing agreements that governments can have with multinationals so that they say, okay, look, we want you to, you know, relocate to our country or have your headquarters here. And let's say if we can make some kind of deal in which you have to pay less than you would pay somewhere else so that we attract you. So, of course, that's not how it exactly works, but that's the basic idea behind these deals. And they are usually bilateral, sometimes also multilateral, but usually it's the government with one multinational and they sit down at the table and make these agreements. And what we've seen in the last years is that they have risen, so that you have since 2015, I think that they were a little bit about 1,000 or a little bit more than 1,000 deals, and now we are at way more than 2,000 deals within the EU. So that's a huge development, and it's still fresh, still new. So, yeah.
Mm. Look, I'm not an expert in this area at all, but at first glance, I don't have a problem with that. Everyone needs to attract investment, and investment doesn't go to the most expensive place. So if the country says, we will give you this offer, and it might be tax incentives, it might be free land to build your factory on, whatever. I mean, that sort of thing, in different ways, has been going on for a very long time and is probably perfectly justifiable. It is a government's job to attract investment.
Right. So this depends on how you, you know, how you see the role of government or what you think is a meaningful way of developing your economy and so on. What we are trying to look at is what does this tell us about the power of global corporations and on the other side also the power of government. So we don't really engage into is it good or is it not good or what does it mean, but really what does this tell us about how corporations behave these days and what kind of leverage they have and how they can actually also play states maybe against each other, or maybe states can have an influence on that. So these are questions that we try to answer, and with these new developments, there are plenty of examples where we can study that. So that's interesting for us as researchers.
Yeah, sure. Do you think this development means that corporations are going to have a larger role? You know, we've got nationalist movements in a number of countries and protectionist movements in others. That makes for a certain degree of volatility that we perhaps haven't seen for a while. Do you think that means that these state-owned enterprises will be used by their states in those battles?
That's something that we are actually really interested in, and that will be also probably the next project that we're looking at. We call it the new geopolitics of global capitalism. So if you think about what geopolitics were, let's say 100 years ago, or maybe also in the Cold War, it was something that was the business of states, basically, right? So states try to enlarge their power vis-a-vis other states. And what we see today is that we have, you know, all these developments of globalization and basically a global capitalism. And here we have this nationalist and populist backlash and also new protectionism rising. And then it's really interesting to see how that plays out when we keep in the back of our head that we still live in times of globalizations, right? So the global economy won't change because protectionism rises, right? But there will be new clashes, of course. And what we also see is that these state-owned enterprises, they could they are not yet used or only in small instances like simple politics, but they could actually be used as global actors, as participants in global capitalism to serve the purpose of states, but also maybe the other way around. So corporations could use states or the situation of states to enhance their interests. So it's a really new dynamic that is in here. And yeah, that's really exciting to look at.
Yeah. You might have a look at Gazprom then. I recall from some time that I spent in Italy, Italians remembering very clearly when the gas was effectively turned down. You know, there's not a lot of gas around. And it makes a very big difference if you can reduce the energy supply to a particular country. It just makes very, very clear where the power lies. Anyway, I have to say, Milan Babic from the University of Amsterdam, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.